This is the Funky Elm Podcast, On the Shoulders of Giants, with me, Millard Roper. So today I'm going to talk about a part of the Bhagavad Gita, and I'm going to compare it to the Yoga Sutras, which the Yoga Sutras are interesting because they're what we commonly in the West refer to as like the tradition of yoga. And it's what most yoga teachers kind of fall back to, which I'm not saying is a fault. Like I fall back on it myself. But it is a book that is meant for somebody who's living an aesthetic lifestyle. So somebody who's kind of renunciated some of the trappings of our common existence of, you know, the way we live life. So in this way, the Yoga Sutras is definitely a powerful book because it's what we lean to in the West, partly just because Krishnamacharya really liked it. If you go to India, it's not a commonly studied text. It is more of an uncommonly studied text. You find people studying the Bhagavad Gita much more. You find people studying the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, these yogic texts that have yoga in them are definitely studied by scholars more, as well as spiritual people in India. But there are some glaring similarities between the Yoga Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita. And I always like to point out this one shloka from the Bhagavad Gita that really proved it to me how embedded the two traditions are. The nice thing about the Bhagavad Gita is that it doesn't necessarily pigeonhole you into one type of yoga, where the Yoga Sutras kind of brings us into this very narrow understanding of how we should live life. And the Bhagavad Gita allows for more of just for some acknowledgement that people are on different paths, and some people that might be a householder, as opposed to going off into a cave and meditating. That's not practical or desirable for most of us. If you spend any amount of time in meditation, or if you've ever done a Vipassana retreat, you realize very quickly that your mind puts up a fight. So to be alone in a cave is not the average desire of the average human or spiritual enthusiast, we'll call them. But there are people out there who definitely are on that landscape, meaning their karmic load is slightly less, so they're attracted to that type of lifestyle that's talked about in the Yoga Sutras. I'm going to talk about the Yoga Sutras separately on another podcast, but I want to talk about this shloka in particular, which links the Bhagavad Gita with the Yoga Sutras, in that you see some very similar Sanskrit and things being said, but I think it does it in a little more elegant way than the Yoga Sutras does. So the Yoga Sutras, its opening gambit is basically now the yoga can begin, right? Atta Yoga Nusasanam, which basically just means now the yoga can begin. Now we've studied we're at the place where we can actually study some yoga, and we're open to it. So from that, that's kind of like the opening, which is common in a lot of Vedic text. So then 1.2 gives us a proper definition of yoga. So it gives us a definition in yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga meaning union, chitta meaning consciousness, and nirodha meaning to cessate or to calm down. Vrittis are fluctuations that the mind gives us. So the mind is very fickle, as we all know. If we go out to dinner, it's very easy to change our mind. I want Italian. No, I want Thai. Nah, I'd rather go for Japanese. You can have all of that happen in the car ride to the restaurant. And that's your vrittis. It's just, I want it. I want it. I don't want it. I want it again. I don't want it again. This is your vrittis. And so what Patanjali is saying, yoga chitta vritti nirodha, is yoga is the calming of those fluctuations. Some people say it is stoppage. I don't really think stopping it clearly is a clean definition, because the mind fluctuates. That's what it does. That's its job. So I like cessate. It's kind of like calming it down. So then 1.3. Tada drastu svarup asvaranam. So then the seer dwells in their own true splendor. Tada drastu. Drastu is the seer, like drishti. It's the same word, drishti, drastu. Svarup is in the state of like a vishvarup. It's like a form. So in your original form, rests and abides, dwells and resides, radiates its own true nature. So this is a nice way. Then the seer dwells in his own true nature. So it gives us, now the yoga can begin. Then it gives a proper definition of yoga, yoga chitta vritti nirodha. And then it tells us what we do, what happens if we do that. And then we can dwell in our own true splendor. It's very nice. 1.4 says, at other times, the seer identifies with the fluctuating states of consciousness. So basically, then I associate with the vrittis. And that's going to lead to my mind fluctuating continually. So how this relates to the Bhagavad Gita, it's in chapter 6, text 20 to 23. They kind of lump them together. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, the state of perfection called trance or samadhi, when one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. So the stage of perfection called samadhi, when one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practicing yoga. So if we look at the Sanskrit, we see it very clearly. You have chittam nirodha. Chittam nirodha. So he uses the word yatra, which is in the state of affairs when one feels transcendental happiness. Chittam, the mind, nirodham, is restrained from matter. Yoga sevaya, by performing yoga. It's beautiful. The state of perfection called trance or samadhi, when one's mind is completely restrained from material activities by practice of yoga. That's a bold statement. Completely restrained from material activities. I don't see the word completely in Sanskrit, which would have been sam or sama, something like this. So we're going to go on and we're going to see if that word comes up, because he might not say completely restrained and he might just say restrained. But again, we are talking about samadhi, so this is kind of a advanced person who we're talking about that's reached liberation. Okay, back to the book. This is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and rejoice in the self. Let me read that again. This is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. So you can see the word self, right? And this is similar to what we saw in 1.3 of the Yoga Sutras. Now the seer can abide in your own true nature. So here we have, he's using the word Atman and then Sukha for happiness. So that's where he's going next. In this joyous state, there's the Sukham. In this joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness and enjoys himself, herself, through transcendental senses, meaning senses that we don't experience here. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he or she thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. That's very Buddhist, right? Like, so most people know that one of the main pillars of Buddhism is that, you know, everything about suffering. So my material desires, they cause suffering. My attachment to those desires, that causes suffering as well. My thought of attaining the material thing, that causes suffering. Once I have it, then I still get suffering. So it's all a bunch of suffering because it's all material. So this indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. That's the last line in it, and I love it. Because it's dukkha samyoga viyoga yoga samjanatam. So dukkha samyoga, dukkha is well, one, he says, before that he says tam vidyam, right? And this tam vidyam is, tam is that you must know, like you must know this. So it's in the imperative, the way he's speaking, which is whenever Krishna talks like that in the Gita, it's like, hey, listen up. You must know this. Dukkha samyoga viyoga yoga samjanatam. So dukkha samyoga. Dukkha means displeasure. It's the opposite of sukha. Sukha and dukkha. So dukkha is displeasure, miseries. Dukkha samyoga. Sam, that's that all. So all of my dukkha is because I'm attached to it. I'm yogad to my dukkha. Right? So all the misery that's arising from me, it's because I'm yogad to misery. I'm attached to misery. Viyoga. V is like negating. And yoga. Here's our yoga. Right? That's negating. This is not yoga. Yoga samjanatam. So the undoing of my dukkha, my yoga to my dukkha, my yoga, my connection to my suffering, this is yoga. Beautiful. That's a very powerful statement. So let me read this again from the beginning. The stage of perfection is called trance or samadhi. When one's mind is completely restrained from material activities by the practice of yoga. So that's your yoga chitta vritti nirodha. This is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind. So you imagine seeing yourself, who you really are. You're not, according to the yogis, you're not fear and anxiety and a ball of, you know, depression and, you know, like however we tend to go through life. Most of us. You're not that. According to the yogis, you are Satchitananda, eternally blissful being. So, just imagine for a second that you were able to see that. But it's almost like we're covered in dirt. And then we take a bath, And when we get into the bath, we start to feel the grime come off, and we see that we're making the water dirty. And we think we're getting dirtier because we're actually seeing the sloth just come off of us. Because underneath, it's pure. The best analogies I ever heard was you could take water that is totally dirty. You know, it's horrible. You could never drink it, right? And then you run that water through a filtration system. And you can drink that water because it's pure now. Because it's been filtered. So the idea is that our soul is like that. Our soul is like the molecules of water, the H2 and the O, that nothing is going to really penetrate. But it just gets covered. And we just need to be run through the filter. And they're saying that yoga is that filter. And underneath that is who we really are. So you get to glimpse that. When one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga, this is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and relish and rejoice in the self. So pure mind. Pure mind. So here they're using the Sanskrit that they're using is Atman. Atman is, could be translated as pure mind or soul. And the way the Sanskrit is broken down, there's a lot. There's a few times where he uses Atman, 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 right? The pure mind and the true self. It's all Atman is the Sanskrit. And then intelligence is there, the buddhi, right? The buddhi. So that's like where you get the word Buddha from, buddhi. Buddhi is intelligence. And usually that intelligence is to realize that you're not the body. You're not this material meat suit that we have. So this is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind. And relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness and enjoys himself through transcendental senses. Again, senses we can't perceive in our present state. It's beautiful. Established thus, one never departs from the truth. And upon gaining this, he or she never thinks or that there is no greater gain. Being situated in a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. I heard Wayne Dyer say this once. And he said, basically he was talking about like as if one had like a spirit guide that always walked next to us. And I've heard this. It's a nice thought. And sometimes sometimes it feels true. That imagine you had your best friend walking right next to you, who was always looking out for you and was always with you from the time you were born. In this way, if you realize that, like, you would never feel alone. And in the bhakti tradition, that is God. That's God right next to you, standing next to you. Sometimes it's hard to feel. Sometimes you get glimpses of it, maybe. So being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. And that's what Wayne Dyer says. He says, if you knew that, you wouldn't have that fear and anxiety because you would know greater, you would know of a greater power. A lot of people have taken psychedelics, and I read this book by Michael Pollan on psychedelics. It was really interesting. And a lot of people who have taken psychedelics have experienced things like this, where it changes their perspective because they realize that they're not necessarily alone and that there is a connection, a common thread between you, I, the trees, the flowers, the fruits, everything. There's a connection between you and the dog, between you and the cat. So it's powerful. And that's basically what Wayne Dyer is saying, and that's basically what the Bhagavad Gita is saying. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. Beautiful. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. Powerful. Powerful. And this is one of the things that sold me on yoga, was this very shloka, was reading it and diving into it and then seeing it in the Yoga Sutras. And again, when you see it in the Yoga Sutras, it's laid out a little easier, laid out a little cleaner in that, hey, now the yoga can begin. This is the opening gambit of the Yoga Sutras. Hey, now the yoga can begin. What's yoga? Yoga is the calming of the fluctuating mind. Okay, that's what yoga is. That's the definition. Well, what happens if I do it? Well, if you do it, the seer will abide in its own true nature. Well, what's my own true nature? I mean, that would be the next question, which they get to. But in this, then they go, well, what happens if I don't do it? Well, if you don't do that, you're going to stick with the vrittis. And the vrittis are the fluctuating mind. The Bhagavad Gita, the way it lays it out, it's a little more nuanced. It's a little more telling you what to do and what's going to happen. How does that look, right? How does it look to be in a state? And I always look before, the one before, and the one after. So let's look at the one before. What does the one before say? Oh, actually, you know what? Let's go back and we're going to read the purport. What Prabhupada says in the purport. Okay. By practice of yoga, one becomes gradually detached from material concepts. This is the primary characteristic of the yoga principle. And after this, one becomes situated in trance or samadhi, which means that the yogi realizes that the supersoul, the Paramatma, through transcendental mind and intelligence, without any of the misgivings of identifying with the self, identifying the self with the superself. So understanding the difference between the Atman, which is the individual soul, and the Paramatma, which is the supersoul, which would be equivalent to God. Yoga practice is more or less based on the principles of the Patanjali system and the Yoga Sutras. Some unauthorized commentaries try to identify the individual soul with the super soul. So basically, some people are trying to say that your individual soul, you don't have an individual soul, and you are just the super soul, and that's it. So he's getting into a little, there's like a political debate almost within the yoga community that's been going on for thousands of years of, are we individual souls or are we just extensions of the super soul? And we are really just trying to bring the super soul out in us. In the bhakti tradition, what they believe is that we each have an individual soul. And then we each have a piece of the divine within us, the Paramatma. So now, but we always maintain our individuality. And so this is what Prabhupada is saying in the purport. Some unauthorized commentators try to identify the individual soul with the super soul. And the monist think this to be liberation, not like the monotheist. So they think that once you connect to that, then you've achieved liberation. But they do not understand the real purpose of the Patanjali yoga system. There is an acceptance of transcendental pleasure in Patanjali's system, But the monist do not accept this transcendental pleasure out of fear of jeopardizing a theory of oneness. The duality of knowledge and the knower is not acceptable by the non-dualist, but is in the verse transcendental pleasure. Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. In this, it can tend to be like mine's better than yours. And it's a problem, I think, in the bhakti tradition that it's kind of like ours is better than yours. Yeah, right? You just want to drift off into nothingness? Okay, go drift off into nothingness. Like nothingness is nothing, right? And this is not actually the way somebody who's a practitioner of that system, which I have a friend who's a very deep practitioner, in this way of thinking. And the way they describe the divine is just as intimate as any bhakta that I've ever met, somebody who's interested in bhakti. So I don't necessarily think that there is this huge debate. I know a lot of people will say, no, there is a huge debate, and I understand, but I think they're speaking of similar things in different ways. I've heard them use the same analogies in the Shaivite tradition. I've heard them use the term, it's like pearls strung on a thread, and then I've heard that's in the Bhagavad Gita, right out of the Bhagavad Gita. And when I've talked to people who've experienced some semblance of oneness, it's like they say it with tears in their eyes, of just joy, of pleasure, of bliss. And it's not, when you talk to some people in the bhakti tradition, they're almost down on it, or they're like, they degrade it in a way. And that can be off-putting to me. Anybody that puts down somebody else's spiritual tradition or says mine's better than yours, or, you know, that kind of thing, that never feels right for me. And I know that's part of this tradition that I love so much, and I have total respect for, but that's where they're getting at. Let's get back to this. The duality of knowledge and the knower is not accepted by the non-dualist. But in this verse, transcendental pleasure realized through transcendental senses is accepted. And this is collaborated by Patanjali, the famous exponent of the yoga system. The great sage declares in the Yoga Sutras exactly what I just read. So, let's go see what the previous one said. So this is 6:19. As a lamp in a windless place does not waver, so does the transcendentalist whose mind is controlled remains always steady in his meditation on the transcendental self. That's beautiful. As a lamp in a windless place does not waver. So imagine a lamp or a candle, and that candle is in a windless place. It's not going to waver. So the transcendentalist, whose mind is controlled, so we are the transcendentalist, and we have our mind under our control, remains always steady in his meditation on the transcendental self. Now, the transcendental self, the Sanskrit there, is Atman. So you're focusing on your soul. Imagine that. Remains always steady in meditation on the individual soul, the Atman. And he doesn't actually use the word meditation. He uses the word yogam. So basically, you are yogad to your Atman, remains always steady in yoga on the Atman. It's beautiful. Again, well, we have many, like we have yogino yata chittasya. And so here we have more of the yogi, basically like the yogi. So we have many, many versions of the word yoga in the Bhagavad Gita, many more than the Yoga Sutras that mentions the word yoga. A lamp in a windless place does not waver. So does the transcendentalist, the yogi, whose mind is always controlled. That's the yata chitta asya. So the mind is always controlled, remains always steady in yoga on the Atman. Beautiful. So then let's look after. So then we have 20 to 23, which we just read. And then you go here to 24. One should engage oneself in the practice of yoga. One should engage oneself in the practice of yoga with undeviating determination and faith. One should abandon without exception all material desires born of false ego and thus control all senses on all sides by the mind. This is a bold statement. Super, super grand. Right, so chapter 6 is interesting because it is very similar to the Yoga Sutras in that he talks about more of a renunciated life, more of a controlled life than he does in chapter 2 or chapter 3, where he's talking about karma yoga and buddhi yoga, like understanding these things. But he'll even tell Arjuna, hey, this isn't for you. You know, you're a kshatriya, you're a warrior. You know, so he's telling him, hey, you're not ready for this. This is kind of like, you know, not everybody should go on a Vipassana retreat. So one should engage oneself in the practice of yoga with undeviating determination and faith. That's lovely. I think if one did that with anything of a sattvic nature, of a growth nature, you know, if we had that ability, that would be amazing. One should engage oneself in the practice of yoga with undeviating determination and faith. One should abandon, without exception, all material desires born of false ego, and thus control all the senses on all sides of the mind. And then this is the next one, 625. Gradually, step by step, with full conviction, one should become situated in trance by means of intelligence. And thus the mind should be fixed on the self alone and should think of nothing else. Gradually, step by step. Step by step. So it doesn't actually say gradually. It says sanai, which is step, and then it says it again, sanai. So sanai sanir, which is like step by step. He put in gradually. That's nice. Gradually, step by step, with full conviction. That's huge. I think I love that he says step by step. Because I need that. Like, I need to have steps. It's like you're teaching standing split. And if you ever take class with me, when I teach standing split, I'll say, you know, raise the back leg, and I'll say, two fingers, one finger, let the hand float. And my teacher, Raghunath, taught me that. And the way he would do it was, or the way I had done it up to that point, was somebody would say, option to lift your hand off the floor and let your hand float. And I would never take the option because I didn't think I could do it. So here, step by step, that's what I need. I need, hey, do this first. then do that. Do this, then do that. And then all of a sudden I realize I'm there. Step by step, with full conviction, one should become situated in trance. Situated in trance. So he has the word buddhi, or buddhya, onto intelligence. So I like that. By trance, by means of intelligence. So you need some level of intelligence here. You need to have like your mind working with you. It's not just boom, I'm enlightened and here it is, right? I need to work step by step. And this, the mind should always be fixed on the self. Fixed on the self. Alone. And should not think of nothing else. Atma samsta. Samstam. Atma samstam. Using the mind to fix on the self, the Atman. So that's, imagine you just meditated on your soul. That's what it's saying. Meditate on your soul. Think of nothing else. Do it step by step. Meditate on your soul. Meditate so you can see your true self. Let's do one more. From whatever and wherever the mind wanders, due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it back under the control of the self. This is great. He's telling us, hey, just when you're about to give up and you go, hey, I can't do this. This is nuts. You know, my mind's wandering all over the place. I can't even get any semblance of clarity here. From whatever and wherever the mind wanders, due to its flickering and unsteady nature. It is unsteady, isn't it? It's unsteady. So sthiram. This is great. It's asthiram. The mind is asthiram. Sthiram sukham. It's from the yoga. So sthiram means to like stand. To stand strong. That's where you get the word stand. So you have asthiram. And the mind is chanchalam. It's one of my favorite words in Sanskrit. So the mind, the manas, manna, chanchalam, asthiram. So the mind is flickering and unsteady. Tata, from there, niyama, regulating. Use the regulating this, the self, through the self. Withdraw it back to the control of the self. So wherever and whatever the mind wanders to, due to its flickering and unsteady state, one must certainly withdraw it back and bring it under the control of the self. That's great. So within this, the Krishna or Arjuna and Krishna are having a conversation, and when they have this conversation, eventually, if we go back, this was kind of Krishna responding to something Arjuna had said to him. And if we go to, well, if we go to 633, we see it there too. So in 633, Arjuna says, the system of yoga which you have summarized appears impractical and unendurable to me. For the mind is restless and unsteady. It's true. The mind is restless and unsteady. So here you have the student questioning the teacher. A good question, right? The system of yoga which you have summarized appears impractical and unendurable to me. For the mind is restless and unsteady. For the mind is restless and turbulent, obstinate and very strong, O Krishna. And to subdue it, it seems to me more difficult than controlling the wind. Boom. Right? I mean, awesome. Here's the word chanchalam. You have chanchalam. Again, the flickering mind, chanchalam mana. So, and it's strong. These are words in Sanskrit. So, for the mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong, O Krishna. And to subdue it, it seems to me more difficult than controlling the wind. Some people say grasping at the wind. You know, so imagine you trying to grab the wind. And in nigraham, and that's where subdue the gra, like graha. So, like, you can't grab it. Let's see what Krishna says. How does he respond to this? Very well thought out question from his student. Krishna said, O mighty armed one, son of Kunti. That's just a fancy name for him. It is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by constant practice and by detachment. So we have vairagya here. He talks about vairagya and abhyas, practice and detachment. These are two words you see in the Yoga Sutras, in the first chapter, in the first pada. So by practice, so how do you do it? How do you control this wind that is so obstinate and strong, the mind? Oh, you practice and vairagya, detachment. You kind of take the volatility out of it. This happens in the stock market. When you do a long trade, you take some of the volatility out of it. So here, vairagya takes that volatility out of it. You just go, no, I'm going to practice. I'm going to do it. I'm going to go hardcore. I'm going to do it. Whether I want to or not. I'm going to wake up every day and I'm going to do it. I'm going to get after it. So the next one. For one whose mind is unbridled, self-realized, self-realization is difficult work. But he whose mind is controlled and who strives by right means is assured of success. This is my opinion. I love when he says, this is my opinion. It's kind of like, it's God speaking. This is my opinion. For one whose mind is unbridled, self-realization is difficult work. So unbridled, it's uncontrolled. For one whose mind is unbridled, uncontrolled, self-realization is difficult work. But he whose mind is controlled, and who strives by right means is assured success. This is my opinion. Oh, this is so good. Arjuna said, this is a question that every student should have. What is the destination of a man or woman of faith who does not preserve or persevere? Who in the beginning takes to the process of self-realization, but who later desists due to worldly mindedness and thus do not attain perfection in mysticism. Basically saying, hey, what if I start this and then I get overwhelmed by life and I fall back to my old ways of, you know, this, you know, just getting caught up in life. And I, but then it's like I wasted all this time practicing and doing all this stuff. Almighty Krishna, does not such a man, being deviated from the path of transcendence, perish like a riven cloud with no position in any sphere? Basically, I'm just lost. I'm just kind of like floating away. And I'm just going to kind of like, I did all this work for really nothing. This is my doubt. O Krishna, I have asked you to dispel it completely, but for yourself, no one is to be found who can destroy this doubt. So he's just saying, hey man, I got some strong doubts here. Krishna said, a transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activities does not meet with destruction either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil. The unsuccessful yogi, after many years of enjoyment on the planets of the pious living entities, is born into a family of righteous people or into a family of rich aristocrats. Okay, so he's saying the unsuccessful yogi, meaning you start and you stopped. Okay, your next time around, you're going to be born into a family of righteous people, of people who are going to put you on the path. And then, and when I say path, it's dharma, but people are going to put you on your path. Or into a family of rich aristocrats. And what that means is not just like, oh, now you're rich and you don't have to do this. No, because you'll have time to explore spiritual subjects. Because you need time. You need time to explore this. If you're fighting to put food on the table, or fighting a war, life can be hard and you don't have enough time for this spiritual, the depth. You can't go, oh, I have to meditate for 8 hours today. No, you have to put food on the table. So in this way, you're going to be born into a family where you can continue your yogic practice. Or he or she will take birth in a family of transcendentalists who are surely great in wisdom. Verily, such a birth is rare in this world. So now you're taking birth into a family of transcendentalists. Your family is set up. They're yogis themselves. Everybody's on board with the program. You're gonna walk that path from day one. On taking such a birth, he never again revives. On taking such a birth, he again revives the divine consciousness of his previous life, and he, she, tries to take further progress in order to achieve complete success. So you're picking up where you left off. So I love this because it really kind of gives us like hope. You're not going to go, oh, I'm just going to stop this and then whatever, it's going to fizzle out. Like, you know, you started playing the guitar and just kind of left that by the side, you know. No, you're going to continue on this path because it's a noble path. So if you'd like to support the podcast, please hit subscribe. It's on SoundCloud and iTunes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can come down, take a yoga class. That's a great way to do that. We have a free kirtan every Wednesday where we talk about all this stuff and sing beautiful mantras with beautiful souls. And if you're interested in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, look up Om Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And hope to see you soon. Bye-bye.